Good morning. I have to look around and see who everybody is that I still remember and maybe be refreshed in my memory too. Nita and I lived here in the mid-70s, going to 81, I guess, and that was a long, long time ago. Some of you still remember those days in the old building. They were some of the best years of our life. I was 30 years old, and now I'm not. And you're as much older than that as I am, but it's just a pleasure to be back with you. And for the couple of days that my family was together, Susan and Sarah are here, my sisters and their husbands, and Larry and Betty can be so hospitable when they take a notion. And we've enjoyed it just tremendously. I was looking forward to getting to meet Hal. I don't think I've ever met him, though I am semi-responsible for him being here. I told Larry some time ago that y'all were looking for someone and Hal might be interested because his father-in-law had told me and they moved here and at least one or two people like them, so I'm assuming that's going real well. I expect things to turn out very well for their relationship here. If it works out as well as my years here did, they will be blessed and hopefully you will as well. I'm not good at these personal announcements. I have special feelings about people and I want you to know that. To get that into words has always been extremely difficult for me. So I'll just talk to you about the Word of God. I'm a little more comfortable with that. Old-fashioned values. And I'm not overly fond of old-fashioned things except people. Some of the newer things I seriously enjoy. I like air conditioning. I think it's a wonderful thing. I don't know how people lived in Texas or Florida without it. I know a lot of people did. I like the newer things, but there are some old things that I like and I think they're seriously important in our life. And I want you to think along with me about some things like this. And I will back up occasionally to look at this screen over here and make sure I'm on track with what's up there. And just let me kind of break it down during the Bible class period into some sections that we can think about. What was old that may not necessarily be there anymore, and I would call the first thing the nobility of honest labor, which I think has kind of fallen by the wayside. I don't think we honor that today in the way that we one time did. And if you have your Bibles, I'll just refer you to some of these. I won't read all of them. I'm going to turn first to the book of Ephesians, the fourth chapter. But back in the book of Genesis, the passage cited up there, 3 verse 17 and 18, Adam and Eve are being expelled from the garden, and God says, "By the sweat of your brow you will work and you will earn your food. The ground will be cursed." Now that was a curse that's removed when Noah and his family leave the ark. We still have briars and thorns and things like that that grow up in our gardens, but I think the curse is not as serious as it was before the flood. Man is going to work, and you'll have to work hard. And if you don't work hard, you'll starve to death. Well, that was not necessarily an evil thing, because in the book of Ecclesiastes, God says on several different occasions, this labor that I'm giving you, that's a joyful thing. It gives us something to occupy ourselves, something to keep ourselves busy. In the book of 1 Timothy, if a man does not provide for his own household, he has denied the faith. But in Ephesians, the fourth chapter, along about verse 28, he who steals must steal no longer, but rather he must labor, performing with his own hands what is good, so that he will have something to share with the one who is in need. Acts the 18th chapter, it is Paul in Corinth, living with Priscilla and Aquila. They were tent makers by trade, and they labored together, providing for themselves. In the book of 2 Thessalonians, there were some of those people who, and they were afraid the end of the world is coming imminently, and we don't need our jobs anymore, and if we've got a little bit of money saved up, we can spend all of that because we want to be broke when we go to heaven. You will not eat because you have not worked. And Paul says, we've taught you that from the time we first came to Thessalonica, the nobility of honest labor. I don't care if you're a fisherman, if you're a tent maker, if you're a shepherd, if you're a farmer, it doesn't matter. I believe man is instructed to work and to do a good job at what he does. And it seems to me, while there are some exceptionally good workers in the world, the attitude toward this has changed, especially with our emphasis on education. I'm not opposed to education. I believe that we need some training to provide for ourselves and our family in this world, but I don't think education is an end in itself. And I think sometimes we have learned in our society to look down on people who do labor. There was a statement made some time ago in my hearing, this person is just working for wages. Well, we all work for wages. Sometimes we're self-employed and we pay ourselves. Sometimes we make better wages than others do. But that's one of the underlying roots, I believe, for our laboring process so we can earn for ourselves and our family. But the idea that menial work is demeaning ought not to be there. A number of years ago, Nita and I lived here. And we were off in Cullman, North Alabama, our ancestral home, on vacation. We had left her parents' house and we had the back of our car loaded down with frozen things that we had worked in the garden for a week, and we had corn and peas and stuff like that. And I got into town to get on the interstate and turn the turn signal on, and it wouldn't work. Well, what was wrong was the battery was drained to the point there's not enough energy to work a blinker because the alternator had quit producing. Well, small enough town, and we've been there long enough, I knew where there was a little shop that fixed alternators. They didn't replace them, they fixed them. I had enough energy to get there at noon. We're breaking for lunch. We have to wait an hour. And there was a mechanic in there that said, no, I'll just take care of you now. Took him about 5 minutes. I don't know if you've ever tried to take an alternator off a car or not. Took him about 5 minutes. He took it into his shop, set it on the workbench, didn't even look, reached for the little wrench that took the back off. 3 of the diodes out of 6 were bad. They're just kind of crumbly. He said, I've got some of those right over here, and he pulled out some diodes and put them in, put the thing back together. In 20 minutes, we were back on the road. I cannot tell you how appreciative I was of the craftsmanship of that man. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to do it. There was not a missed step. And he didn't charge me an exorbitant fee for doing honest work. I appreciate that. A doctor at that moment could not have helped me. Now, if I have a broken arm, I don't need a mechanic. I need a doctor. Honest labor ought to have its place in our life where we honor somebody for doing a good job. We lived for a while in coastal North Carolina, and one of our neighbors was a mechanic, and he was a good mechanic. He worked on boat motors most of the time, and then he opened his own little garage. Well, one day he was called to the elementary school, and two counselors got him in a corner in a little room and said, you are a terrible father because your son is a terrible student. He can't pass his classes. He is going to be a miserable failure in life. He won't be able to take care of himself. You're not doing well, and he's not doing well. And this man was my age, and he came home in tears because of what he had heard. And I had to say to him, now, Bob, stop and think for just a moment here. There are two educators, two teachers, and they make a pretty good living. And they're telling you something. Did you ever stop to think that you make more money than both of those people put together? And his son could do exactly what he could do. The little boy at 12 years old was buying lawnmowers and rebuilding the motors and selling them. I rebuilt a lawnmower motor once. I had some parts left over. It never worked after I worked on it. He was doing things at 12 that I can't do. He can take his dad's place in a business and make a good living. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't have teachers or counselors. I'm saying that we shouldn't think education is an end in itself. The nobility of honest labor, whatever you do, do a good job at it. It irritates me to check out of a grocery store or Walmart or Kmart or whatever mart you might have in a small town where the people know each other, and the one in front of me says to the cashier, don't work too hard. Don't ever say that, because I'm next in line. And I'm thinking, I want you to do a good job at least through one more customer. Work hard today. Make your boss proud. Make your parents proud. Make your God proud. Because God tells us things like that in this life. There was a newspaper article not too long ago about a man who won the National Garbage Collectors Championship. Did you ever think about something like that? Did you ever think where you would be without someone like that? Garbage piling up. Somebody needs to do that job, and I want them to show up on a regular schedule. Because my can is out there, and it's ready for them. And it needs to be emptied so we can fill it up again. Do a good job. Whatever it is that you do, do a good job. He is an honest, hard-working man, ought to be a compliment in any society. God's people above all ought to know this. Now, there ought to be a colon in there, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 10, where God says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Do it. I believe the last part of that expression is, you can rest in the grave. Work while you're alive. Now, yes, take some time for a break, for a vacation, for some time to enjoy your family and friends. But you need to learn to work, and to work energetically, and to work intelligently at whatever you find to do. Hopefully you'll find something that can suit your personality, a job that you enjoy. But whether you enjoy it or not, it's your responsibility to do a good job. God's people above all ought to know this. It is not just an old-fashioned value in the sense that I learned it when I was a child. My father learned it. My grandparents learned it. Because God taught it to us long before I came up with a thought that might resemble this. Well, the wisdom of economy, and I'll look at my watch every now and then because I've already been told what will happen to me if I go over time today. The wisdom of economy. And I think this is a serious thing in our society. There are a couple of verses that I want you to look at with me in the book of Ecclesiastes. And I don't think this is all that popular a thought when we come along in the modern day. Ecclesiastes chapter 5. Let me read with you verse 4. When you take a vow to God, do not be late in paying it, for He takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. Better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Do not let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness. Rather fear God. Now let me turn back to the book of Proverbs, the 22nd chapter, and read with you a verse here. Proverbs 22, verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. Now I want you to underline especially that last expression. The borrower becomes a slave to the lender. We live in a free country. Not if you owe somebody. It's not free anymore. You're in debt. And we have to learn to manage our debt. Some of us remember the days when there were no credit cards. Can you think back that far? What did you do when you got to the end of the month and the money's all gone? You did without. You walk through a grocery store and you count how much it's going to be as you put it in your basket, and you've counted how much cash you have in your pocket. You could write a check, but it better not bounce. We don't live that way anymore, do we? I had a man tell me not long ago, you know, I can buy a car on this credit card. My limit is that much. I can buy a car. And I said, that'd be kind of stupid. You can finance a car for, what, 4%? And this is 18%? He wasn't saying, I'm going to do this. He was just kind of bragging. I've got that kind of limit. See how rich I am? No, that's a credit card. What you're doing is spending your tomorrow. You're not spending the money you have in your pocket. That's tomorrow. the borrower becomes a slave to the lender. And the first passage we looked at in Ecclesiastes, if you make a vow, I'll pay this money back, then you're obligated to pay that money back. You've made a vow. God hears that, and He knows that. Wise advice to me is something like this. Spend some, you'll have to. Save some, you need to. Give some away, because I believe that's what God expects of us. Seems to me that God's people have always been liberal givers, and I don't mean it just in the sense of a Sunday morning. If there is someone who needs help, we will minister to that person. I cannot tell you how often back through the years God's people, churches, have sent multiple thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to works in overseas areas. There are people, years ago, there was a group in Zimbabwe in South Africa who had not seen rain for 5 years. The drought was intense. Christians are starving to death. And congregations sent money to relieve the distress of the saints in areas like that. We can take care of that. We send money everywhere. That's the give some away that I mean. And it doesn't just have to be overseas. We will know people in our midst, people in our community who need help. The provision God made in the Old Testament, and I think you're aware of what He said, you will go out and harvest. We see Ruth gleaning in the field of Boaz. Here is a field planted in a square. You harvest in a circle, and the corners are left for the poor. And you don't harvest it until it's all gone. Even in the circle, you leave the gleanings for those who need help, and they come and gather it. God's people listen to rules like that. God laid them down in the Old Testament, and I believe that He does for us in the New Testament as well. You'll have to have some money to take care of yourself and your children and your family, and I believe family there is extended if a man will not take care of his own and his household. I think that's beyond the doors, the borders of his initial house. Responsibility is ours. Can I do that? Have I saved enough to take care of things like that? Our attitude, I think, on this point is just so important in so many ways. We live in a society that's never learned to say no to itself. I can have anything I want. We teach our children that. Have you ever checked out of grocery stores behind them? And kids are snatching things off the shelves faster than their parents can put it back. No, no. Okay, I'll let you have that. Just be quiet. We bribe. Guilty. Because I'm not a parent anymore. I'm a grandparent. And it's my job to spoil them. It's the parents' job to say no to them because I want my kids to love me and my grandkids to love me, and we bribe that love. Do we need to learn to say no to ourselves? Let me refer this kind of back to a national scale. Back in the 50s, the United States government used to work real hard to balance a budget. We didn't always do that. We'll have to borrow a little bit of money to get through till the next time. We can leave off this program and this program till the budget is balanced. When's the last time we balanced a budget? When's the last time we tried? What Congress does is say, we want to spend money for this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and it's everybody's wish list, and we'll add every little project that your state wants, and we can't say no to you because I might need your vote for my little state. On and on it goes until our deficit is trillions of dollars. We don't have the money for this program. We know that. But it doesn't matter because we can borrow. And people have kind of adopted the same program. I can buy the area where we live. I do not live in a $1 million house. I want you to understand that. But there's one across the road from me. One down the street from me. And I look at the people living there and I think, how do you make payments on something like that? What kind of income must these people have? And I don't know the answer to that. Are they happier than we are? No. They just don't have to see each other. The house across the road has 5,000 square feet. There's a husband and wife living there. I kind of got the idea that he lives upstairs and she lives downstairs, and that brings peace, right? Not necessarily. But we can afford it. We can have it. Now, in the same period of time since the 1950s to the 2000s, what's happened to the morals in America? Well, as the deficit goes up, the morals seem to go down because we never learned to say no to ourselves. I can afford anything I want. I can have anything I want. I never have to say no to myself. Doesn't matter if God says homosexuality is right or wrong. We can do that because we have an attitude in our society that we can do exactly what we want to, and nobody has to tell me no. It's an anything-goes society. Morals have gone down. Let me offer an illustration that I find to be fairly simplistic. I don't know the last time you had a speeding ticket. I kind of notice when we're driving almost anywhere from Texas that Texas cars pass everybody else on the road because our economy is booming. We can afford a ticket. Did you ever say to a state trooper, just write it out and let me get on my way? I don't care. We may not say that, but that's kind of the way we feel. I can afford it. It's not a big deal. Do I stop for every stop sign in the community? No, but I hesitate as I go through. I don't want to have a wreck, but if I get a ticket, it's not a big deal. It's a suggestion. It's not a law. I can afford to violate laws. And we bring the same kind of attitude toward God's law. It's not a big deal. I can afford to make mistakes. Nobody cares because we all do the same thing. And I think we need to go back and learn the wisdom of economy, of balancing a moral budget, a spiritual budget, as well as we do the physical. Well, let me change topics again here. The dignity of simplicity. Do we live in a complicated society? I have one of these old-fashioned phones. I don't text because I don't know how. I think it's part of my program. It's just never been activated. I don't care. By the time I got a cell phone, everybody had quit using them. Isn't that irritating? I want to text you because I really don't want to hear your voice. I got a cell phone to talk to, and I tell people, it's a telephone. Do y'all know what that means, the word? You need to look the etymology of that word up. A telephone, calling from a distant place. It's not a texter. My 5-year-old grandson has an iPhone. 5-year-old kids do not need iPhones. I'm sorry. You may have one. He can play games on that all day long. You can raise and lower the temperature in your house. You can start your car. You can do anything in the world if you've got the device for it until the device breaks. And we don't know how to turn on a switch. We had a friend years ago that stopped at a gas station and mashed the button and locked her car. And her battery died. She couldn't get back in the car. We've had women at church like that, men too, whose battery died while they were in service, and we don't know how to get in because my little key fob for the automatic door opener has a key stuck in the top of it that you can get out and turn it, but we don't know how to do that anymore. Because society has just gotten so complex. Well, there are Bible verses, I think, that talk to us about things like this, and I'm still back in the Old Testament, so let me do the passage in Ecclesiastes first. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. And verse 29. Behold, I found only this, that God made men upright, but they have sought out many devices. Now, the devices here are not computers and cell phones and things like that. The devices are that we can't just be honest and open with each other anymore. We have left simplicity behind, and we have learned to be devious in our activities. In the book of 2 Corinthians, the 11th chapter, Paul uses what I find to be an interesting statement. I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his craftiness, your minds will be led astray from the simplicity and the purity of devotion to Christ. Well, what's he talking about there? What do you have to do to be saved? Now, we learned, I don't know, somewhere back through the years, that, well, we call them finger sermons. Hear the Word of God. In some way, you have to come into a knowledge of what God expects in your life. Hear, believe, you have to accept Jesus as the Son of God. You can't just say, I sort of believe. It has to be a belief that motivates your life. Believe, repent, I've got to realize that God's way is the best and I'm going to change my way to follow His way. Confess by faith in Him before men. And I'm persuaded that that's not just before I'm baptized, that it's constantly through my life. I need to be willing to say to people that Jesus is the Son of God, and then I'm baptized, I'm immersed in water for the remission of my sins, and you're saved. But what about grace? But what about? And we want to complicate, I think, what God has made simple. What's the organization of the church? Well, it's a congregation, and it has elders and deacons and maybe an evangelist. Do we have a chief elder, a presiding elder? Have you ever driven through some of the denominational buildings around town, the parking lot, and look at all the signs? It's incredible. The offices we've placed, because what happens when you give a man a position? He has to get a promotion sooner or later. So you're promoted from being, and I tell people all the time, I'm the senior pulpit minister. For many, many, many years, I was also the junior pulpit minister because I was the only one. And now I have someone working with me. Well, I'm older than he is, so I'm the senior, even though he has preached for a number of years. Well, I want a promotion. I want a new title for my job. We complicate that which God has made simple. And Satan is behind a lot of this by saying to us, well, you need a promotion. You need to be noticed. You need someone to know who you are and to extol your virtues before everybody else. And we've left God out of the situation. It is our responsibility, Ephesians the third chapter, the entire last paragraph, is that through the church we magnify the name of God in the community. That God may be praised in the church. I am to so live that God gets magnified and not myself. But we complicate things that God has made simple. Children can name the 5 points of salvation. Grown-ups can't. Because we've forgotten so much about that. Well, I think this transfers into our everyday life. The bondage of station is kind of what I call it. We lived in a military community for a number of years. And in the military, things can be very different than they are in the church. Okay, we had officers and enlisted men. Now, let me tell you, when we get to church, they're all the same. It may be the sergeant who's doing the sermon and the general who's sitting over here. But I went to a retirement ceremony for one of our guys. He had been a sergeant major in the Marine Corps for years, and that's an honorable station. We had at the same church a 2-star general who had retired from the Army, who went to his retirement ceremony and sat on the podium with the other officers. Now, theoretically, in the military, generals don't speak to sergeants in the sense of honoring them. But in our society, we do. Because here we are all the same. But this station kind of gets in the way. That on the military base, there's an enlisted club and an officer's club. And you can't come to my club. And if we're not real careful, this will bleed over into our everyday life. Station. Do you own a house? Does the house own you? Something wrong with the plumbing. You've got to fix it. Something wrong with the breaker box. You've got to fix it or see to it. You own a car? Something breaks on the car. You have to fix it. We have to make payments. We have to pay the taxes. We have to pay the insurance. All of these things and things and things kind of build up until we are bound Have you ever known people that went to work so they could buy a house and car? And own the car so they could go to work to pay for it? Sometimes we get ourselves in awful situations in life where life is filled with what I consider to be artificial rules. Now, the best illustration I can give you of this is something that happens in the Amish community, and you may have read stories about this. You know a little perhaps about the Amish people. I think they're highly respectable in so many ways in life. They are hard workers, and I will tell you that as farmers, they produce more per acre than anybody with a tractor. And they still work with mules and horses. What I'm thinking about in particular is their little argument over how many suspenders a man can wear. How many suspenders does it take to keep your pants up? Just one. Two is pretentious. Now, if you travel through an Amish community, you will see some men with two suspenders and some with just one. I am superior to you because I am simple. Well, I'm superior to you because I can afford two, and I want you to know it. And we do that with ourselves in life, everyday life. We make rules that may or may not be binding, and we do this sometimes in the church. And I caution you to be real careful about things like this. I know a church that said, a man cannot wait on the Lord's table if his hair touches his shirt collar. Now, I don't mind elders suggesting to men that you need to be appropriately attired and that you might want to be a little more decent and in order and things like that. But elders aren't legislators. They don't make rules. But we have to have some order, and sometimes we step too far in trying to maintain this order. Well, God said, I've got something here that's simple. And Satan comes along and says, well, that's too simple. We need to complicate it just a little bit to make brethren argue with each other. And I can engender within you bitterness and jealousy and envy and all of these things that James says, this is the wisdom that is earthly and sensual and devilish. I think we ought to be able to reason with each other. We should be able to talk with each other. I feel... But what governs us ultimately is a God says. And what does God say? And to stop with the artificial rules and think about what God says. You've probably heard this expression a number of times. We buy things we don't need to impress people we don't like. And that's our society. Why do we do that? Because we get caught up in trying to live on a higher level than those around us. It's human pride. Now, have some pride in your place. Keep yourself presentable. Take care of your house, your car. I don't mind if you paint it and you wash your car and you do all of these things to look better. That's just, and it's not pride that's the opposite of humility. It's the pride that's the opposite of arrogance that we need. Humility, rather, that's the opposite of arrogance. We ought to have good feelings about ourselves because we worked hard to get where we are. But be careful about elevating ourselves, and especially in erecting barriers that divide people from people. Philippians chapter 4, verse 12 and 13 are verses that mean a lot to me. The concept of contentment, if you will, and here's what Paul is saying in these two verses, that I have learned to be abased, and I've learned to abound. I've learned to be filled, and I've learned to be hungry. I've learned the secret of contentment. And that's a word to me that is more special than the word happiness. Content. I'm content with what I have. Maybe with who I am. I think that's something that we ought to strive for, to be content. It doesn't mean I have everything I want. It means that I've learned to control my wants. I'm content. Life is good. Could it be better? I don't know. I don't know. I think we need to work on this constantly in our lives. And then I love verse 13 where Paul comes along and says, I can do all things through Him, Christ, who strengthens me. There's the secret of my contentment. I can do without. I can abound. I can have a lot. I can fare sumptuously every day, but that doesn't elevate me beyond other people. I can be content. And that's something I think we need to work on. Obligation of duty, if you will, that I think in our society is a very unpleasant word. You have a duty. You like it when somebody shakes their finger at you? I have a duty. Well, the fact of the matter is that we have a duty, and I don't think that ought to be the primary word in our life. In Luke, the 17th chapter, and this will be Jesus talking to the people in that day and age, and I think to us as well. And he says in Luke 17, along about verse 10, "So then you too, when we do all things which are commanded, say, we are unworthy," the older translations say, "unprofitable slaves or servants. We have only done that which we ought to have done." The older translations use the word duty. We've only done our duty. Duty is what we ought to do. It's what God imposes on us. And if I've done everything God expects me to do, God commands me to do, I am an unprofitable servant. I have not exceeded God's expectation for me. I have a duty. I have a responsibility. It is an ought to. You ought to do this. And we ought to. To me, it is what God demands. Now, there's another expression I want to share with you, and that is what God deserves. And I want to look with you at this passage in the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Because it says a lot to me as a preacher. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, beginning in verse 16. "If I preach the gospel, I have nothing to boast of, for I am under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this voluntarily, I have a reward. If against my will, I have a stewardship entrusted to me." Now, that can sound harsh as we read it in the Corinthian letter, but it comes across to me in this way. Now, there are Sundays that I have some good thoughts and some good feelings, and I want to share my thoughts with you. I love God and I love His Word, and I found something that excites me. And just let me talk to you about this. And then there are some Sundays that I just as rather not preach because I don't have an inspiration that day. I don't have a thought that's worthy of sharing. Now, God's thoughts are always worthy of sharing. Please understand. It's just that I'm not sure what I want to say and how I want to express it. And I'm fairly confident when I get in the pulpit that I'm going to get a C- on this sermon. And folks will ask me, "Have you got a good one for us today?" And I'll tell them, "Well, you just have to wait an hour and we'll find out," because I don't know. But whether I want to preach or not, I've got to. It's my job. People come expecting that. Now, to me, that's duty versus something else. I'm preaching because I love doing it. I'm fascinated by the Word of God. I think it's the most simple and the most intricate thing in the world, that God looks into us and He knows my thoughts before I think them. He knows my feelings. Because people haven't changed throughout the centuries, and God's book is eternal. It's just incredible. And you have to fall in love, not just with the book, but with the God who revealed all of this to us, and think, how could He know that? And He just does. But Paul says, sometimes I preach because I love to, sometimes I preach because it's my job. Neither one of those is a bad idea. I have a duty. Woe to me if I do not preach. Now, I'm not saying that if you can preach and you don't, that that's a sin, because I don't believe that's an accurate statement. But I kind of come back to this idea, this is what God demands. This is what God deserves. How can I not offer Him what He deserves? I have a duty. Duty to me is softened by the concept of my emotion toward God. Can I fall in love with Him over and over and over again through the years? Why do I try to obey His will? Because He deserves it. Now, I fail, and I look at myself and I just feel miserable at my failures, because God deserves more. God deserves that. Duty tells me that I need to do this. Love tells me that I want to do this. Duty. But in our society, this is not a good word. Because folks look at us and say, well, you owe this to God, and we don't like to owe anybody anything. It's a free country. We should be able to do exactly what we want to. And we know that's not right, but we will shout it to the heavens anyway. We have a duty. And I love that expression that Jesus utters in Luke the 17th chapter. When I do everything God expects, I'm an unprofitable servant. I haven't exceeded that. God expects a lot, but God deserves it as well. Well, the true worth of character. And let me talk with you about that for just a little while. And let's go back to, there are a number of verses in the Bible, Old and New Testament, to talk about this. But to me, some of the clearest are in the Proverbs and sometimes in the book of Ecclesiastes as well. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 1. A good name is to be more desired than great wealth, and favor is better than silver and gold. In the same book, if we go back to the 10th chapter, Proverbs 10, verse 7. The memory of the righteous is blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot. Now, I want to stop there before we read Ecclesiastes and think, what's your memory going to be when you exit this earth? Oh, that was just a rotten guy. The memory of the wicked will rot. It's what Solomon said. Because he had observed so many of these things, I believe, through the years. A good name is to be chosen. Now, the difference to me in character and reputation is that reputation is what people think of. Your character is what you really are. And you can't overemphasize what people think of you, because some people want to think poorly of us and some people want to exalt us. What are you really? And this is when you look at yourself in the mirror. And again, just let the Bible verses pop into your head. When James says that sometimes we look into the mirror of God's Word and we turn around and forget what kind of people we are. Well, we really need to examine who we are and how we think and what's going on in our lives and all kinds of things like that. But character is what really counts. Character is who you are. When you're not trying to deceive yourself and you're not trying to deceive others, well, a good name is to be chosen. And we want people to think well of us. That's a good aspiration in life. And if they do, that's wonderful. If they don't, that should not upset us overly, because we know what kind of people we really are deep inside. Who are we? And what's our character? And are we trustworthy in society? And can God's people think well of us? Character counts. And we need to understand that. Is that, there was a second bell? Am I time to quit? Okay. I'll stop there. The passage in Ecclesiastes is going to